Our next speaker is David Lankus. Dr. David Lankus is the director of the Information Institute of Syracuse, IIS, and he is an associate professor at Syracuse University's School of Information Studies. And I'm going to speak slowly as people kind of migrate back and settle in. David's past research projects include the Gateway to Educational Materials, GEM, the Virtual Desk Reference, VRD, and the Educator's Reference Desk. He is currently involved in projects related to the National Science Foundation's National Science Digital Library and several IMLS studies.
Institute for Museum and Library Services.
Institute for Museum and Library Services Studies. I was fortunate to serve on a panel with David on the transportation information, the future for transportation information. It's a special report 284 from the National Research Council. It was an excellent experience. David was the director of the Education Resources Information Center, known as ERIC. It's a clearinghouse on information and technology. He was the director from 1998 to 2003, and he co-founded the award-winning Ask ERIC project in 1992. And I did go out to Ask ERIC the other night and looked at it. It's a portal to information in the education community, and it's pretty cool. It's a comprehensive, easy-to-use, searchable, internet-based bibliographic and full-text database on education research and information that also meets the requirements of the Education Sciences Reform Act of 2002. David was a visiting scholar to Harvard's Graduate School of Education and a visiting fellow at the National Library of Canada. So, welcome, David.
Good afternoon. I bring you lessons from beyond. I don't mean that in a sort of creepy psychic way, but merely the idea of beyond environmental and GIS data. When I was first put on the agenda, my question was why, because clearly from my bio you see all the amazing work I've done in the GIS field. And I found out it's because I'm a loud New Yorker academic and can wake you all up after the food. So what I mean to do here is I'm going to make an assumption. My assumption is that you all do brilliantly within your agencies and organizations in managing and organizing your data. What I'm really going to try and focus on is what happens beyond those organizations and beyond the organizational boundaries. And what I think we're going to accomplish is some of the things that we're learning as we talk about integrated information systems and collaborative systems on a large scale. We're getting pretty good at building large-scale collaborative systems, and they're really different than the way they used to be. Lenny mentioned a system called ERIC, and ERIC actually started in 1968. And the idea was, look, there are all these journals that all the educators should be reading to improve their classroom work, but no one can find them all. Let's build a database, right? So it's the let's build a philosophy. If something's wrong, we're going to build something, and we'll fix it, by God. And the bigger, the better. And the more complex, even better still. And so the grand, glorious challenge in the 60s was to build a database with lots and lots of fields. And let people do their searches between CIJE and RIE, and is it a level 3 CIJE? And it was obscure, which means it was beautiful. And what we really have started finding out as we move forward is that if you want to build large-scale collaborative systems in the internet age, what you don't build are large-scale centralized systems with one code base. You build lots and lots and lots of little distributed systems. And so I want to talk about that. And as I was thinking about a metaphor to put around it, the Web 2.0 kept hitting my brain. Now, warning, buzzword zone. There are probably three groups of people when I say Web 2.0 in this group. One that goes, oh, God. And the other that goes, huh? And then the other goes, yeah. Web 2.0 is just a way that people have been putting terminology around. It's sort of the survivors of the dot bombs. Right, we had the dot-com era, and we were all going to make lots of money, and we all should have invested in Netscape, and then we should have all invested in Google, but we didn't. Or else, frankly, we probably wouldn't be here. I wouldn't be here. But what happened was people looked at it as the collapse of that bubble economy, and they said, oh, all that grand, glorious talk about the web changing the way we do things was bull, forget it, it doesn't work. When in fact what happened was all the economic models behind them were fairy tales, but a few really good ideas began to emerge. And what happened is people have now looked at what worked and survived out of that era, what's worked since that era, and what can we learn about this for large integrated and collaborative systems. Well, we learned a couple of things. First of all, we learned that Web 2.0, new web applications to succeed, need to be based on open and lightweight technologies. That what we're really worried about is how we can get data in and out. We want to build black boxes to a degree, but ultimately not many people are, they're starting to not trust those black boxes too much. They want to get in and see what's happening underneath them. And so they worry about things like open source. And even the open source community for this has gotten much more sophisticated. Open source used to mean I wrote obscure C code, now you can see it and not understand, as really... No, all the techies here, no one's ever faced that situation. It's open source. It's got to be easy for you, right? It's like, no. But the idea that you can look at the source code, you can make changes, you can alter, particularly with higher-level languages like Java and lots of techie talk. But increasingly, open standards are important so that we can move. It's the point of connections that we can move back and forth. Now, some of these technologies that you see a lot in Web 2.0 are really becoming really important and useful. I heard a lot this morning about moving things onto the web. Well, moving things onto the web is a great way of saying absolutely nothing, right? Moving something onto the web means I have a URL to a sign that says go away, or I have a URL which says come hack me, or I have a URL in which you can get this glorious laser light show occurring on your desk. Well, so what do we mean when we talk about moving on to the web? Well, increasingly we're talking about things like XML. Being able to get away from the what file format is it today and saying I'm sending you an XML data stream and it will go into your database and into my GIS system and we can move things in a much more standard way. We're talking about things like AJAX. AJAX is a grand new term for things, a bunch of different technologies from cascading style sheets to asynchronous communications over HTTP. Once again, I apologize, I'm going in and out of obscurity, depending on, I guess, who you are, which of that. But it's the more desktop-like environment, right? On the web, MapQuest is the classic example of when you used to look up things and you wanted to move on the map, you'd click, you'd wait 10 minutes, and there would be the new map, and you'd want to go a little farther south, and you'd wait 10 minutes. And now we see things like Google Maps and Yahoo Maps where you just sort of scroll seamlessly. That's all done through AJAX. JavaScript, frighteningly enough, has managed to survive, and we're seeing really interesting things with JavaScript. I've heard Google Maps brought up a lot, and JavaScript, this is really weird. A technology that was designed to make little dots bounce in animations and commercials are now a way of sending GIS data to a renderer in remote locations. Okay. HTTP binds it all together, and increasingly looking at things like RSS or real simple syndication as a way of taking sort of itemized data and pushing it out and syndicating and building really cool websites. So I'm not going to spend much time here. This is sort of, you know, my street creds to the techies, and then we'll move on to the larger view. What are some of the Web 2.0 things that we should consider when we talk about building collaborative systems among partners? I'm assuming that what we're talking about is building a community of practice, not only within like agencies. You know, I'm a Department of Transportation, you're a Department of Transportation, like they're all exactly the same, but really in a diverse community and oftentimes building partnerships with people you may never know, like the Boy Scout troop and the school system. People who have not been traditionally seen as consumers of GIS-level data are increasingly consumers of GIS data. Eighth grade classrooms want your data. And you say, well, this isn't a partnership we're used to making. We don't do that. How can we enable that without derailing what we're doing? And frankly, take advantage of the nice little goodies that come with the saying, we support education. First of all, social networks. The concept that we are building data systems needs to begin to evolve, that we're thinking of building systems where data go into it and people come into them. And people aren't just taking the data and walking away, but they're leaving things like, what did they do? Did they have additional data? What was their comment? So working on the wisdom of crowds so that we can talk about, before there was the idea of the how rough is your data? You know, that's where the bald eagle. I thought that was a great example. That's where the bald eagle is. Today, tomorrow, that's where the bald eagle is. Well, can we have people who are really interested in citing these actually have data that shows migratory patterns and hunting patterns? And so we don't have to collect that data, but someone can. Loosely coupled APIs is a way of saying, if you have these really powerful systems, start making them really easy to get at. Start thinking of a GIS as sort of an engine that you can build lots of different applications upon. So the big thing these days are mashups. Google Maps, I'll keep bringing it up again. You know, everything from crime data being mapped against Google Maps in Chicago to public restrooms in San Francisco to book locations to all these things we never thought about. Rather than trying to have to specify every potential application of a system, what are the capabilities of the system that other people can worry about where we're going to apply them? Museums, libraries. I can get to more specific examples, though it's not my area, but the idea of environmental impact organizations, concerned neighbors over development, urban sprawl. The idea is you don't have to say this is exactly what they're going to do with it. What you say is, if you send me this data, I'll send you back a map that looks like that. If you send this data to me, I'll send you back this table of information. So, and included in that is a change in attitude, which is the right to remix. And this, frankly, might be the hardest institutional sell in many organizations. The idea that we're not going to understand and specify every application of the system, nor are we going to necessarily prevent the application of the system in certain situations. That we're going to assume that the public has a right to do with this system, including putting bad data in their application using our systems on the back end. That's kind of tough. People go, I don't like that. But at the same time, if you don't allow that level of experimentation and, frankly, that loss of control, you're not going to find the really innovative, cool stuff, and you're not going to build sort of interesting, unexpected partnerships. Hackability. And I don't mean that as in come in and steal our data, but hackability is the sign that, you know, if I take this capability of putting a dot and I can associate it with this capability of putting a hyperlink into it, I can get this whole new system that you never expected. Permanent betas. The concept that software is never done. That when you are building, I mean, Google Scholar has been beta forever. Google Maps is still beta. Google Earth will always be beta. The concept that you don't have these rigid release schedules where you've gone through 12 months of testing, but you actually let the community test it for you, gives you this rapid influx of systems. Add to that the open source capability, and suddenly you're in a very different development environment. Now, jump ahead a little bit. You can't be in a development environment and do that when you're building on a code base of a couple million lines where it's all one big system. You want to break it up into smaller systems that you can constantly refine. Software that gets better the more people use it. The idea that this data isn't just something that gets displayed on the screen, but it has a context that people come in and use it. And we want people to use it. We want people to understand it, but they become part of the system themselves. And the rise of folksonomies. Now, it may sound odd for a professor in library science to say, you know, don't go with a completely defined data dictionary that's top-down with, you know, one-to-one matching of a thesaural structure and blah, 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 blah. The idea that people can go in and have multiple names for multiple locations can be interesting and useful. The people can go in and have multiple names for multiple activities can be useful. Can you find commonalities? Folksonomies are a great way to find out sort of what's on the populace mind so that you can go in and use their language. You can go in and identify hot topics you may not have anticipated. These are some of the capabilities, some of the attitudes that, once again, I'm calling loosely this Web 2.0 approach that I think can be applied when we're talking about building collaborations. Oftentimes, building collaborations are seen as building things, and in fact, we're talking about building communities. Clearinghouses have migrated from gateways and gatekeepers of information to places of communion, of people coming together and working together and talking together, virtual workspaces, that type of thing. So here's my example. We all have our favorites. It was going to be Google Map, but that's so, you know, yesterday at 4 o'clock. Anyone know Zillow.com, a few of you? Zillow.com to me, is a really good example of this sort of mashup mentality. Zillow.com, Seattle startup. We'll see if they ever make any money, but at least for now, they're a good demo. Zillow.com is in the business of real estate. They sell real estate. They don't sell real estate. They get you valuations of properties. You can navigate and say, how much are things worth in this neighborhood and that neighborhood and things of this nature. And so a lot of what they've concentrated is on the algorithm of taking multiple diverse data sources, primarily governmental data sources, county records, and coming up with an algorithm going, this house is about worth this and this house is about worth that. But that sort of sounds okay, fine. MLS does that kind of thing. Why do we need this? What they've done, interestingly, is they take these public data records and they mash them up against things like Microsoft Live and Local, which has aerial photography and satellite photography. So what happens is you start with an example of Seattle. Actually, I think this is Kirkland, which is across the way. And you say, okay, I want to live there because it looks like it's got a football field. That's exciting. And you begin to zoom in, and obviously I could go do this in real time if you want, but as you get to the neighborhood level, it begins now a layer of data on top of it. And then what we can do is we can zoom in further, and you can actually begin to look at a house. And this is aerial photography that someone in this room probably provided them, by the way, where you can, by the way, look at east, south. You can rotate around the house. You can see the satellite composite image. And if you take it one more level, you can actually see their valuation over time. This is all their algorithms that they put around it. Now, I'm not here to get you into the real estate business, and I don't want you to invest, but what I'm trying to say is, one, this is your data. There's a very good chance this is your data. Two, what's interesting about this is Zillow here, as an organization, a company, has this. This is their contribution. Right? That's not. That's Microsoft Live, which, once again, has your data. And then the aerial photography and all this information that they're putting together from multiple sources in multiple places. They're gathering this data. And so now you can imagine people taking the time to comment upon it, to correct it. When Google Maps came out, and I was talking, I was down at the RAC meeting in North Carolina, a few people came up to me and said, Google Maps is great, but their maps are 14 years old. Right? In some cases, their maps are 14 years old in some cases. How can I give them new maps? And Google doesn't have a number where you can just send them a new map. And in fact, one of the things that we're dealing with in the library science industry is how comfortable do we feel with a repository that we can't get at and see? It's that openness side of it. So the question becomes, you know, how can you update this data and become a provider of this data? Yeah, maybe in a commercial context, but maybe in a non-commercial context. Frankly, once again, I'm the outsider from beyond, naive about this, but economic development in the state library organizations is pretty big. How can this be seen as an economic development activity with the capability that you're building anyway to serve the main mission of transportation environmental impact can turn into another engine that in unexpected results and consequences? So that when we talk about going out to the web, we don't just mean the idea of static interfaces that people can click and wait for, but that people can begin to contribute. So the example is to move from the idea of system to moving to this ecosystem. Now, this is my 8th grade world studies definition of ecosystem, which is as diverse agents working together in a space. And so we start with the basics, right? We have the map. We have the location. So we're getting really, really good at this. I mean, I'm amazed by what folks talk about here with changing projection aspects and edge detection and things that are way above my head, but we're getting pretty good at this. But the idea is to then look at that only as a basis for building other services. Now, there are the traditional services, putting more mapping and specialized mapping data upon it, document analysis so that we can associate environmental impacts and documents to a given location or a given project, right? Data sets, traffic information, all in some sort of security environment. This is what you guys do well. The thing with Web 2.0 is when you start talking beyond the agency, all of these can come from diverse sources. So that can be Texas, and that can be Virginia, and that can be who knows where, right? But then to begin talking about what else can we begin to associate with this type of information, well, we can associate things like output. How do we connect to other systems so that when there's a new environmental impact study coming out, people can be alerted to that through things like RSS feeds so they don't have to sort of guess if it's been there. They can integrate traffic information so they can pull up your map of a location and pull up traffic alerts on a given place. The idea of directory information. One of the things that I'm really interested in is when you begin talking about a clearinghouse, is a clearinghouse is increasingly about getting to the right people. So mapping, not only mapping places and activities, but people and expertise, so that around any given location you can have a conversation. I want to go to this environmental impact study, but I'm interested in who wrote that. I'm interested in what expertise went into building that layer. I want to have a community conversation. We had some new apartments and easements being put into the development I'm in. I'm not happy about it. Let's all get together on my website and talk about it, but we're going to pull up accurate maps from yours, right? And so the idea of people, and then the idea of photo information. I love these photo logs, and I apologize, this is probably 1964 technology to me, but the notion of being able to associate people driving by a site with a site kind of makes sense. What would be really interesting, of course, is that everyone these days is walking around with a camera and a cell phone. How can we associate those kind of pictures on a direct way with what's happening? Right? Now, this requires a couple of things. In order to do these types of tasks, we need to build a lot of lightweight applications as opposed to building one really big application so that we can change in and build different components, lots of APIs to get at really low-level information. An API is an application programming interface. Sorry. An API is just the idea that over the internet you say, send me a map, and this is what it sends back. So it's like a request and a return. That we need to migrate emerging critical data service applications to core infrastructure. As these fun things are developing, as we're saying, these people over in that weird wildlife group came up with some data that we really need and we're worried that they're going to disappear tomorrow, we're going to take that as part of our core infrastructure, and that's going to become a layer that we maintain. So the idea of migrating from what's out there to what's in here, we need a policy to figure out how that data, how permeable we are and how we do it. That we need to build public XML-based APIs, we need to make it really easy to implement. I mean, I used to say easy enough for an eighth grader to implement. Now I say easy enough for a tenured academic to implement. The idea that without C++ and Java coding, with basic HTML and JavaScript knowledge, that I can build really cool, sophisticated applications that I can show in my eighth grade class and I can show in my community development organization and I can show to my legislator and that I can build these applications and give it away. And this is the big thing that I post to think about. I would not presume to tell. Certify, don't censor. And it's that concept that once we make these APIs out there, once we take our data and turn it loose to our fellow departments of transportation, nonprofit organizations, metropolitan planning organizations, Boy Scout troops, anyone can do with this data what they please. When I see something that's really good and when I have a process in place to identify best practices and best performance, I can go and highlight it, I can go and showcase it, I can go and document it, and if it's really, really good, I can bring it internal and begin to support it on a regular basis. So you're building this ecosystem where new stuff's always popping up and the best stuff can be identified and brought within. So my conclusion is, this is a picture that someone put together about sort of a, what if a committee designed a digital camera? Which is, it looks really good and it's got a lot of functionality, but you begin to question some of the choices. Like, for example, you'll notice down here, oh wait, I have a laser thing, right? You want a menu, you want select, that makes sense. If something doesn't work, we should be able to call Spock. Oh, yeah, let's have it do Coke, gin, beer, wine. Give me some ideas, sex, money, pizza. Tell me when to take a pee break, etc. The notion is that if you continuously refine bigger and bigger systems, they get a bit unwieldy. They begin to match what everyone thought over a 30-year development life cycle as opposed to what we need today. What, in fact, we've learned is that you begin to break things apart. Now, you find natural matches. No one sort of anticipated that a cell phone and a camera was a natural match. But it's a natural match. And so, okay, let's put those together. But the idea of, well, a PDA and a computer. We know that you need a PDA and a laptop. I don't care what kind of PDA you have. It's just not a laptop. And so you begin to understand through invention, through community, through use of things, what's useful. So with that, questions?
Any questions for David?
Please. You know, standard academic answer. It depends on the application, blah, 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 blah. Overarching techie answer. As long as I can get to a command line in a server, I don't care where it is. And if it's under bandwidth, it's backed up in a data farm, that's fine with me too. Just don't take away root access. All right, street creds again. In essence, if what, you know, in library land, we like to say we didn't let the cabinet makers organize the cards in the card catalog. You know, just because someone's really good at maintaining a system in environmental conditions with redundancy of bandwidth and servers, that's fine so long as they don't restrict access to the data and the applications that are going on top of it. So, you know, I'm also convinced that there are production systems that you should make sure are in their environment, and then you should have about 50 scattered around your office that you can reboot at any time for experimentation. So. You call it rapid prototyping. You call it cascading design. I understand what you're saying. And we had this problem with contracts from the U.S. Department of Education about how do we write deliverables around research, right? How do you turn something into measurable, accountable things when what you're really asking it to do is innovate? That comes back to the breaking things down to small parts. Not every one of those parts do you want to be constantly changing. I think it's the idea of building in to the understanding of legislator that there's a life cycle around applications, and the more that you can refine that these are not just applications but functions, that we need to revisit this function on a regular basis to make sure that it's up to task, I think is something you can build into. But this is the problem with every developer, which is when am I done and how am I done paying for it, right? So there are ways to do it, but none of them are happy. None of them are comfortable. That's an honest answer.
Other questions?
Where do folks keep up with these ideas and thoughts you've got here?
In the Web 2.0 discussion has, which is a lot of this, you get into things like long tails and all this other stuff. O'Reilly has a conference on it, but frankly, if you put it in Web 2.0 into Google, you'll find tons of discussion about it. A lot of buzzword-laden discussions with it. But... it's ironically, the internet's the best place to find it, and blogs are the best place to get this information, because what you're lucky enough to get are some of the innovators who are developing it. They document their process, but they don't do it through some formal procedure. They put it on their blog. And so what you find, and with RSS, you can read 50 of them at a time. So actually, a lot of this development that's happening and thinking is happening in the blog community, and we can identify some of them for you. Yes. Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, the real men don't need firewalls, right? Yeah, but well, and I think that there are a couple ways to handle it. I mean, this clearly is an attitude. I said one of the hardest things is going to change that attitude. I mean, with the Department of Education, we had lesson plans where we wanted teachers to go in and comment upon them. But the Department of Education freaked out because they couldn't vet the teachers ahead of time to make sure that they were blue ribbon appropriate. And what we tried to convince them, and this is a hard argument to make, quality is subjective, but the idea that you have less secure servers, where you identify a zone, you sort of say, look, we've got, this is the hardcore stuff. It's got to be locked down. this is the stuff that it's okay if it goes down on a regular basis. And you and it's a pretty easy argument to make when it's project-based, like around the horn toads, and then you just don't turn the server off at the end of the day. But with these lightweight APIs, with all that's going back and forth, a request for information, not actual sort of low-level system development, I think you could make an IT, I could make an IT argument that these are less secure apps, these are really secure apps. System Nazis will always hate the idea of anyone that they don't have an ID badge on accessing systems. They just got to get over it. And the fastest way is to call up a legislator and say, I got all these, you know, students looking for toads and they won't let me put it up. It happens. Sorry, lizards.
Last question. We got to move on.
Sorry.
That's in itself a nightmare, because how do you know that the data they're updating is...
And that's the idea that data lives where data is created, that they're not updating your data. They're accessing your data and updating their data. And so that, for example, if I'm mapping, back to the community example, I'm mapping incidents of increased crime because of this new development, that data sits on my server. It calls for you for a map, but that's my data. And you can say, I don't like that data. Dave doesn't do a good job, so therefore I'm not including any sort of environmental, official impact or study. But they can, they're welcome to their data. And so the idea is the data should never commingle. The data should be off in a distributed system. It's the functionalities that commingle. It's the call for this information. But no, I'm data purist. I have a real hard time commingling data from multiple sources. But I've got no problem with commingling them on a given application at a given point. Don't store them together. So, thank you all.
Thank you.